great deal of work to bring this program for us, and I think the least the rest of us can do is join the Vancouver Institute. Tonight's speaker is the head of the zoology department at this university. He came here in 1958 from his native England. He had taken his bachelor's degree at the University of Wales and his doctorate in entomology at Oxford. He became a professor in 1968 and head of the department, the zoology department, in 1976. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Of his many publications and awards, probably the two most important to a teacher in entomology are the Gold Medal of the Entomological Society of Canada, which he received in 1975, and the UBC Master Teacher Award in 1976. He will address us this evening on evolution or special creation. Professor Stetter.
Justice Seaton, ladies and gentlemen. My topic is evolution or special creation, and there should be a question mark after. The aim of the lecture is to first explain why I think this rather ancient question is topical at this time. I then would like to trace the fate of the question over the past century. And I'd like to show how this question has been treated at different points of time. And I'd like to finish up by pointing out that the question can never be resolved in a satisfactory manner and never really needs to be asked in the first place. Why is the question topical? Now, as many of you know, in 1925, the famous monkey trial took place in Dayton, Tennessee. In this, John T. Scopes was fined for teaching evolution in defiance of the state's anti-evolution statute. This statute forbid the teaching of evolution. Scopes was found guilty after a 10-day trial, and although his conviction was later nullified by the Tennessee Supreme Court, the statute remained on the books in Tennessee until 1967. It was then taken off and remained off for only 6 years. For in 1973, the Tennessee Senate passed a new evolutionary statute. It was voted by the Senate 28-4, 1 against, by the House 54-4, 18 against. And I'd like to read this law to you, if you will allow me. And I quote, "Any biology textbook used for the teaching in the public schools which expresses an opinion of or relates to a theory about the origins or creation of man and his world shall be prohibited from being used as a textbook in such systems unless it specifically states that it is a theory as to the origin and creation of man and his world and is not represented to be scientific fact. Any textbook so used in the public education system which expresses an opinion or relates to a theory or theories shall give in the same textbook and under the same subject commensurate attention to and an equal amount of emphasis on the origins and creation of man and his world as the same is recorded in other theories including but not limited to the Genesis account in the Bible." This was just one of the series of anti-evolution statements made by various boards of education. Let me quote you three more. 1970, the Texas State Textbook Commission refused to authorize the purchase of several new published textbooks because they treated evolution in an outspoken way. The commission wrote, and I quote, "In the category of life science, grade 7, each book shall carry a statement on an introductory page that any material on evolution included in this book is presented as a theory rather than a fact." In 1971, the Board of Education of Columbus, Ohio, passed a resolution encouraging teachers to teach special creation right along with evolution, whenever the origin of life was discussed. And then in 1972, the State Board of Education in California, one of the largest school systems, of course, ruled that all science textbooks used in the California school system must present evolution not as a fact, but as a theory. The 1973 Tennessee law represents probably the culmination of this resurrection, as I like to call it, of the question. And although the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit struck down this Tennessee 1973 so-called equal time law on the 10th of April, 75, classing it as unconstitutional, we may be sure that this trend and this new awakening of the creationist stance has not gone away. Now, one of the chief spokesmen for the creationists at this time, and particularly of a certain group of creationists, is Dr. Duane T. Gish, who is an associate director of the Institute of Creation Research and professor of natural science at the Christian Heritage College in San Diego. Now, the Institute of Creation Research and its associated Creation Research Society was founded in 1963, and according to Gish, is an organization of Christian men of science, all of whom hold advanced degrees and are fully committed to the acceptance of biblical and scientific creationism as opposed to evolution. They believe that science should be realigned within the framework of biblical creation. Dr. Giss, as many of you probably know, has a PhD in biochemistry from Berkeley and has published a book entitled Evolution, the Fossils Say No. The Creation Research Society also have a book out which is available in the public schools called Scientific Creationism. Now, there's no doubt that the writings and public lectures by particularly Gish has reawakened this long debate. Now, I'm well aware that their statements do not represent the mainstream of religious fundamentalism, that there are others that hold similar views, but I think we have to look at the activities at the present time because they are, again, lecturing in Canada on this topic. And wherever you go to any of the public schools, it is one that you're always asked about. I am going in this talk to refer mostly to the statements of the scientific creationists, and if this offends any other creationist that might be in the audience, I apologize. The idea of creation will always be with us, so we better deal with it. Now, let me say from the start that I cannot agree with all of the statements that have been made by these scientific creationists, but I do believe that they've made evolutionists sit up and take note of what they've been saying for the first time for many years. They have done us a service. Scientific creationists have renewed the debate between evolutionists and creationists, and they've also caused a brand new debate between evolutionists themselves. And what I'd like to do first is to place the question, evolution or special creation, in what I see the larger context. I'd like to ask why we're concerned, so concerned with this question. And I think it's probably best stated by quoting from E.M. Keating's book, The Broken Bough. And I quote, "Nothing arouses man's curiosity more than himself. From the dawn of history to this very moment, he has addressed himself to two basic questions of human existence. What are man's origins? What is his destiny? He continues, the answers are sought not so much for their own sake, but for the possibility that they might serve as reference points from which to turn in towards the central question of human existence, what is man? End of quote. Now, it is evident that these questions have occurred independently to all races of men, all tribes of mankind. It is also evident that all of them have been equally successful or unsuccessful in dealing with the questions. Before the scientific age, man resorted to myth as a simple explanation for things that they found difficult or impossible to know through direct experience. Myth is a Greek word meaning story, usually applied, of course, to stories of the gods or heroes. The term myth, as I use it here, is not referring to a falsehood. Father Roberts has defined it a while ago in a similar lecture series that we ran. He said, myth is a dramatic representation of man's cosmic integration by means of symbol. It necessarily is portrayed by a story. Now, according to the French philosopher Henri Bergson, we would find life unbearable if we had to depend only on our intelligence to make sense out of the world. He argues that nature came along and rescued us and prevented intelligence from destroying us by enabling us to respond by creating myths to which we could react when we couldn't find an appropriate answer. In other words, myths allow us to deal with questions which we can't answer in any other way. Myths are essential to mankind. They're a fundamental attribute. Over the years, they've served in many contexts, keep tribes together, so that each member of the tribe has the same counterfeit experience, as Bergson would say. They've served in place of formal and rigid laws, and of course, they're in virtually every religion. In general, I think, judging by their occurrence, Homo sapiens cannot exist without myths. There is no culture today without myth. Man's remarkable talents for inventing myths is surpassed, according to Roy Gallant, only by his ability to believe in them. It seems that the problem of origins has been central to the thoughts of all mankind, because origin or creation myths have been found in all primitive tribes, all races, all creeds, and all religions. And characteristically, they always relate in some way to familiar objects or experiences. I'd like to quote one such creation myth from the Dieri of Western Australia, and this is to be found in a book by Freund, Myths of Creation. And the Dieri tell the following. Early one morning, from a fissure in the midst of Perigundi Lake, came forth the crow, the shell parakeet, and the emu. These birds lay weakly in the wet sand until the sun infused them with vital heat. And at last they changed into man, rose up, and dispersed to every quarter. Now, this is a creation myth. There are many, many others, similar creation myths. On analysis, these innumerable creation myths have one or two recurrent themes. One can classify them into three groups. Firstly, those in which the earth and the life on it were fashioned from the part of some being's body, often a monster. There's a second group that have the earth and all its life being formed out of the word ocean or out of water in some form. And a third in which some supernatural being creates first itself and then the world around, out of nothing. Now, one of the numerous myths that relates the formation of the world out of water is the creation myth of the Babylonians. And it goes by the formal name of the Enuma Elish. This creation myth, often called the Babylonian Genesis, was taken apparently from an earlier creation myth of the Sumerians. And in this creation myth, there are gods of sweet water, gods of salt water, and the gods of mist. And these, by various reactions which we won't go into, produced a male god of silt, Lamu, and a female god of silt. And remember, this is in Mesopotamia. Silt is to be seen in the rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. These are regular events that they can witness, and this goes into their creation myth. The gods then gave rise to the sky horizon and the earth horizon, the sky above and the earth, the creation of the earth with a female earth, a male sky with appropriate gods. These had then Anu, the god of the sky, as an offspring, and from this arose the god of the earth. And having then, in this myth, had a large number of gods around, and in the myth evolving through time, and the change of a concept of gods and the importance of gods, the Babylonians created Marduk, the elected king of the gods, and arranged for all of the other gods basically to be destroyed. So he took over. And so that you must see Marduk kills Tiamat, and Eu kills Mumu and kills Apsu and imprisons Mumu. In other words, this is a creation myth involving both a concept of gods and a concept of the environment in the sense of earth, sky, and so on. Now, biblical scholars tell us that this creation myth, suitably modified to have one almighty and eternal God, is the basis of the Judeo-Christian religion's Genesis accounts. It is this myth modified that has come down in Genesis. It has come down, of course, in two separate accounts, the one contained in Genesis 2, which is the older, which talks about Lord God, the deity Lord God, paraphrased from the Hebrew deity Yahweh or Jehovah. This account, which we know apparently now originated about 350 years before Genesis 1, describes the way in which the Lord God caused it to rain upon the earth. And let's see the similarity in some sense. Rain upon the earth, water, caused the mists to arise, notice mists, and it reports that man was formed from the dust of the ground. The Lord God then planted a garden eastward of Eden, placed man therein, and after forming every beast of the field, created woman from the ribs of the first man, Adam. Now, you're also fully familiar, no doubt, with the Genesis 1 account, which goes back to about 500 BC. It refers to the deity simply as God, and not Lord God. And it outlines the creation of the heavens and earth and everything therein in 6 days. Now, it's this Genesis 1 account that is central to most of the discussions in the Western world and English-speaking world when we talk about creation and evolution. It is never pointed out in any of these discussions that this is just one of the many creation myths. The Genesis 1 account, which is the one usually referred to, is no better, no more important, no lesser important than any of the other creation myths when you put it in its global context. Now, just as scientists have tended to treat everything in terms of Western science, just as students of human agriculture and civilization have until recently followed the views of the late V. Gordon Child and tend to think of everything in terms of the Near East and Western civilization, so too we have concerned ourselves with a creation myth which is typically Western, typically centered coming out of ancient Mesopotamia. And it's this Western view, of course, that we're discussing here, but I'd like to say that it biases us if we only think of creation in the very simple context. Now, while the strict fundamentalists accept the literal accuracy of Genesis, this is not the only creation stance taken in the West. There are a number of divergent creation stances taken, and I'd like to, for the moment, try to get you to think of the concept of origins under four headings. I'd like to think of a fundamental creation view, a progressive, and I'll explain these in a moment, a progressive creation view, what I like to call a theistic evolution view, and fourthly, a scientific evolution view. Let me just outline these four in detail. The fundamental, or what I call the fundamentalist creation view, this states that the account of the creation in the Bible is historically and literally accurate. In essence, God created all kinds of organisms, both living and dead, in 6 days. In contrast, the progressive creation view states that there have been a number of acts of divine creation, each followed by a certain amount of natural diversification. The third, the theistic evolutionary view, here basically states that evolution takes place as though it is by natural processes, but these are divinely directed. And fourthly, the scientific evolutionary view states that all life and its diversity is the result of natural processes alone. Four, and let's make this very clear from the start, four does not deny the existence of God. Just says he's not involved. As a subsidiary statement to four, the view is that non-living gave rise to living, simple gave rise to complex, and that there's a regular sequence of forms through time. Now let me at this point make a distinction for you. Let me define, separate evolution from the theory of evolution. This is rarely done. It causes a great deal of confusion, often much of it conveniently caused. Evolution can be simply defined as descent with modification. Evolution is descent with modification. It is a proven fact. As Throckmorton said in way back in many years ago, 1968 in fact, he said that concrete and absolute proof that organic evolution has occurred was presented when a comparative anatomist demonstrated for the first time descent with modification. This is the fact of evolution. The theory of evolution is something a little bit different. It is a theory and no more. The theory of evolution, at least as I prefer to frame it, says that life and all of its diversity is the result of natural processes. Life and all of its diversity is the result of natural processes alone. Now, while it's believed that this life and diversity occurred on Earth, this is not a necessary part of the theory. In fact, some people believe that life now arose somewhere else in outer space. Now, all four of these views on life that I've outlined here should be considered no more than theories, since none of them have absolute proof. There is little chance of ever obtaining absolute proof, even if the scientist really, in the scientific method, needs to look for proof. Science deals with ascertainable knowledge. When a scientist accepts the task of studying the origins and diversity, he's accepting, at least theoretically, that it is in the realm of ascertainable knowledge. Now, it should be noted that scientists in general do not claim always to be able to explain things. We do not guarantee answers. It's a method of going about things. Now, most scientists, of course, in general, would accept some theory, some scientific theory of evolution, but they're not unanimous on the details. I'd like to discuss the various ideas on life and explain some of the problems, and I'd like to go through these one by one. I'd like to show you a version of the creation as depicted by Dürer. The fundamental account, as we've said, is related to the account in the Bible. It is a problem. It's a problem to scientists looking at it. Very cold, hard facts. First, we notice there are two accounts in Genesis. Apparently, the account 2 is older than the account of Genesis in chapter 2 is older than the account in chapter 1, although we tend to read them in the reverse order. Some creationists do not accept that there are two accounts. Other creationists say that the Genesis talks about a creation, a catastrophe, followed by a second creation. This is somewhat confusing to the scientist. There is then, secondly, a problem of 6 days taken literally. 6 days and the other time frames provided by the Bible. Many of you know James Ushup, Archbishop of Armagh in Ireland, calculated from the timetable in the Bible that man was created in the year 4004 BC. Now, this is not consistent with the geological timescale, which we now have for the origin of the solar system, origin of the Earth, and so on. The figure we have at the moment is 4.6 times 10 to the 9 years. The oldest rocks on Earth are 3.7 times 10 to the 9 years. The oldest remains of man go 0.3.5 million years back. Now, even accepting that there are errors in our dating methods, using potassium argon, C14, and so on, the errors can't be great enough to cause us to confuse 5,981 years ago with 3.5 million years ago, let alone 4.7 billion years ago. The fact that in Genesis chapters 4 and 5 give ages of Adam of 930 years, lived to 930 years, Seth to 912 years, Noah's father to 777 years, Noah to 950 years, this causes to doubt the exactness of the times in the Bible. If nothing else, it demonstrates that at least something about Homo sapiens has changed with time. There's a major problem for scientists in the sequence of events in Genesis. Light and darkness, day and night, morning and evening were created on the first day. And it wasn't until the fourth day that you had the sun, the moon, and the stars created. Now, this is not the sequence that is consistent with our present understanding of the origins of the solar system. Now, I'm aware that some creationists talk about a cosmic cloud, but I do not see any mention of cosmic cloud in Genesis. There is then the whole question of accepting and treating Genesis as a scientific document. Biblical scholars tell us that it was never intended to be a scientific document. It was never intended to be treated in this way. The creation account in Genesis, as I've tried to indicate, we believe goes back to the Babylonian Enuma Elish and the earlier Sumerian myth. Mesopotamians were concerned, as we know, with both theogony and cosmogony. Theogony, the theory of the Genesis, the gods; cosmogony, theory on the genesis of the universe. They were concerned with both. Their myth, the Enumerilish, as we've seen, mentions both. At the times of the coalescing of the tribes of Israel under Abraham, at a time when the prime concern of the Israelites was survival, and in particular the establishment of one God, they took over the Enumerilish myth. In particular, they took it over because of its theogony. It became the account that they used, but they were concentrated on the genesis of the gods and the formation of their single gods, which they were to follow, rather than its cosmogony content. The Israelites did not concern themselves with cosmogony. They did not interpret their Genesis account in terms of cosmogony, and to do so now is to misunderstand the evolution of Genesis and to misunderstand the history of the Christian religion. The Genesis creation account was never intended to be a scientific document, and therefore we shouldn't give it a scientific status now. At least that's my version, and I let the biblical scholars argue amongst themselves. But I think you'll find that many biblical scholars will agree with the statements. There is then another point about Genesis and the fundamental view, which was made by J.B.S. Haldane in 1954. He pointed out that the creation theory is unverifiable except by revelation from a witness of the event. One can neither do experiments to bear on the theory nor bring about factual evidence to support it. Unless one is fully convinced that one of the existing accounts of the creation is such a revelation, it should not be accepted until alternatives have been disproven or shown to be highly improbable. By choice, a scientist should accept the scientific method. He should order his ideas and concepts in a scientific manner. A scientist is bound by his method not to take something on faith. He is bound not to follow something that he knows cannot be tested, proven, or, in modern terminology, refuted. Okay, let's go to the progressive creationist view. Probably said enough about the fundamentalist views. Basically, the idea here is concerned, and the idea is the one that has been picked up by the scientific creationists, I should point out. This is where they fit. Progressive creationists and the scientific creationists believe in a number of acts of divine creation, each followed by natural diversification. I call it evolution. They refuse to use the term evolution in this context. Now, the debate between the progressives and the fundamentalists concerns the interpretation of the word kinds as it occurs in Genesis 1. And the problem is an explanation of the variation and modification of species that we now know occurs in time. Species are not constant in form or behavior, and therefore they cannot be regarded as immutable created entities. However, the major taxa are fairly constant without any intermediates. Everybody knows what a general cat form is like. Everybody knows what a general dog form is like. But there are lots of varieties of cats and there are lots of varieties of dogs. And this view basically says that the kind that was created was the higher group, the order or the family. Not every type of cat was created, but the kinds refers to the cat type, the dog type, the bat type. And it's interesting that Linnaeus, who gave us the basic method of giving a scientific term to animals, he originally believed in creation of species, and then when he discovered that species varied, he quickly changed over and believed in the creation of genera. The scientific creationists have gone one step further, and they now believe that it was the orders of plants and animals that were created rather than all of the single individual species. They accept variation, they accept descent with modification, but they do not call that evolution. The time sequence, the sequencing, the timing, and everything that I talked about in the fundamentalist also applies to the progressive view. There's a more serious point that the progressive creationists have brought up, and this concerns gaps in the fossil record. The scientific creationists rightly point out the presence of rather consistent gaps in the fossil record in everywhere that you look, in all fossil strata, all groups. There is a systematic lack of intermediates. There are no missing links that are demanded by most evolutionary theories. Now, in this debate, there is one fundamental flaw. The debate now, I should point out, as propounded by Gish for the scientific creationists. This is the flaw in their belief that evolutionary theory is dependent upon the theory of natural selection. They believe that the evolutionary theory, the theory of evolution, is dependent upon the theory of natural selection. And indeed, there are many writers in evolutionary textbooks that they synonymize these two. But this is quite incorrect. Evolution is not synonymous with natural selection. Natural selection is a process of evolution. Natural selection is not the process of evolution. Darwinism is natural selection. Darwinism is not evolution. Darwin, in his Origin of Species, didn't accept that natural selection was the only process involved in evolution. And he said that it's wrong to state otherwise. However, I should point out that there are many evolutionists that consistently make this mistake. Now, Gish, in the writings of the scientific creationists, in particular in his book, Fossils Say No, Gish points out that there is in general an accepted model of what we will call neo-Darwinian evolution, and I'll go back and explain that later. And on these two, this model of the evolutionists and the model of the creationists, he says that you can make certain statements and make certain predictions. And he has produced a creation model and an evolutionary model, based upon natural selection. And he makes some statements about it, and then some predictions. They are fairly straightforward. The creation model says that it was the act of the creator. The evolution model says that things go on by naturalistic, mechanistic processes due to properties inherent in inanimate matter, and so on. Down the bottom, variation is speciation limited, variation unlimited, and so on. Goes on from this to predict two things: that the creation model would predict the sudden appearance of a great variety of highly complex forms. The evolution model would predict a gradual change from the simplest to the more complex forms. Creation model would predict sudden appearance of each form. Evolution model would predict transitional series. This is a model, remember, based upon natural selection being the sole guiding force. Now, one can debate this in some detail. I don't want to do it at the moment. But if you take the creation model and the evolutionary model as laid out there by Gish, it is true that the creation model, as he outlines, is a better model for the facts of geology than the evolutionary model. You can follow and say from this that that evolutionary model is not acceptable then. I would agree with that. It does not follow, therefore, it does not follow, on the other hand, that because that evolutionary model doesn't work, that the creation model is correct. There are other processes, as I've mentioned, in evolution other than natural selection. This is a model that's based on natural selection being the only guiding force. There is one or two facts from the geological record which are more consistent with the evolutionary model if you go one stage further, something that the creationists in this discussion do not do, and look at the sequence in the geological record. In the creation model, there should be no sequence. They should all occur at the same time. In the evolutionary model, there should be a sequence. And if we go back to the fossil record, we can find that there is a sequence. You will not probably be able to read that, but there is a sequence there if you're down into the Precambrian of symbol organisms, more complex organisms as you get up through the Cambrian, vertebrates occurring late, and so on. You can depict this in a number of ways. Let's go to the next one. I think that's a better one. Here is one more familiar. A sequence of succession that is evidence in the geological record from examination of the vertebrates. And Legros-Clark has pointed out that there is a succession of vertebrates through time. Both the temporal sequence and the structural sequence is impressive and combined give proof of an evolutionary advance. This is not consistent with a creation model. Now, in spite of this bearing, we should point out that there are some question marks at the bottom of those diagrams. We do not know the intermediates. We do not have missing links. And as Russell said many years ago, we follow the theory of organic evolution by natural selection, like Darwin, in spite of, not because of the geological evidence. The fossils may say no to evolution by natural selection, but they do not say no to evolution by natural processes. The argument, and an argument that is ripe in scientific circles, concerns the importance of natural selection. Most evolutionists do not synonymize now evolution with natural selection. Natural selection is now seen by many evolutionists to be a minor, unimportant aspect of evolution. Let me go quickly to the third theistic evolution. I can go through this rather quickly. This basically says that evolution takes place by natural processes, but they're divinely directed. Now, there's really no need to accept this one, to follow this one. You can't deny the possibility. There's no way of knowing if there's a supreme being that's directed evolution naturally to make it look as though it is only natural. There's no way of knowing whether there's a supreme being trying to fool the evolutionists. You cannot prove it, but there's no need to accept it. The evolutionary theory is the one that basically says that there is no divine intervention necessary, that it can go on without. And as I pointed out, the debate in the evolutionary theory is on the processes involved. Now, I'd like to go through the debate through time quickly, and I'd like to show in doing this the way that the religious views have been put forward and changed, and then the way in which the evolutionary views have been put forward and changed with time. One can break the debates in time up into these few simple groups. In the pre-Darwinian era, that is before the experiments of Reedy and Pasteur on spontaneous generation, or special creation prevailed. There were two opposing ideas, spontaneous generation or special creation. When the experiments by Reedy and Pasteur showed that spontaneous generation didn't seem to be working, it automatically favored the creation concept. At the same time, early in the pre-Darwinian era, the Greeks were making statements that we, and in fact Darwin, has called evolutionary. They talked about natural processes. Empedocles believed in chance, and so on. And if we look at the century before Darwin, we see that it was largely the fossil data that was causing problems. It was the discovery of fossils that did much to whittle away the beliefs in creation and the achievements of the creator. And we should point out that much of the activity of scientists of this time, right from the time of Bacon, the activities of scientists, the scientists believed that they were in unfolding a divinely ordained system. This was true of Boyle, Newton, and others. They were not doing science for the sake of science. They were doing science to illuminate the masterful work of the Creator. But it was the discovery of fossils and the realization as to what fossils were that really caused problems with the creation account. The spontaneous generation account, as I said, was downgraded by the work of Reedy and Pasteur. There was a debate in the pre-Darwinian time, and this debate was basically centered in Paris about 1750, between 1750 and 1830. There were a number of scientists there that were putting forward various processes of evolution. Buffon was pointing out the importance of the environment. He mentioned struggle for existence and the battle between the fecundity of species, that is, the tendency to increase in numbers, and the constancy in numbers. Lamarck was there. Lamarck was teaching and talking about the inheritance of acquired characters, or the terminology that we put it in today. He was talking about an internal organizing force. He was using terms like inheritance, but that is not exactly the term inheritance as we use it today. Cuvier was there. Cuvier was a geologist, believing that each of the geological strata showing radically different organisms represents a separate creation. As Gardner says, he was the most catastrophic of the creationists. He was opposed in England by Lyell, who was teaching that things take place slowly, and he was opposing catastrophes. And then in Paris also, there was St. Hilaire putting forward what we call saltation. Darwin accepted all of those as valid. Darwin accepted inheritance of acquired characters. He accepted embryological change. He also postulated the process of natural selection. He also believed it was a major force, but he did not believe that it was the only force. He accepted the inheritance of acquired characters. But he said that there are some features of animals that could not have been brought about by the action of natural selection. The weakness in Darwin's theory, as we know, was that he didn't have any genetic basis for his ideas on natural variation. He accepted blending inheritance, and of course he didn't produce any experimental evidence in support of the process of natural selection. Now, when Darwin came on the scene and wrote The Origin, there was considerable debate. But the debate there was not so much about the processes. It wasn't solely about the processes. The debate was a little bit mixed, and we can divide it into three main areas. There was a debate run mostly by Samuel Butler, who complained that Darwin neglected to give any credit to all the people that had gone before him. He failed in the first editions to mention Buffon, Lamarck, even his own grandfather. Darwin silenced this part of the debate very easily, because when he wrote a sixth edition, he added an extra little piece at the beginning entitled An Historical Sketch of the Progress of Opinion on the Origin of Species Previous to the Publication of the First Edition of this work. And this traced back many of the evolutionary ideas to Lamarck, in fact, right the way back to Aristotle. But there's one thing that Darwin did in The Origin of Species which has caused much of the recent confusion. Darwin did not distinguish between the general theory of evolution and his theory of natural selection. He made no distinction between these two. And as Darlington pointed out in Darwin, when he wrote a book on Darwin's place in history, this is what's caused the confusion. And a lot of people like to forget that the confusion has been straightened out many years ago. There was a major debate in Darwin's time on the importance of natural selection. Was it the only process involved? Could it account for all of the variation? In particular, they asked, could it bring about major changes of evolution? Could it explain the origin of new organs? Two scientists in particular said that it couldn't. One was Richard Owen, and the other one was the person that championed Darwin's ideas, T.H. Huxley, popularly known as Darwin's bulldog. Huxley did not believe that natural selection was a sufficient explanation for what he called major evolution. Darwin did not believe that his process of natural selection was all-powerful. He states, and I quote again, "To suppose that the eye, with all of its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberrations, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I confess, absurd in the highest degree." The problem at that time was major evolution. The problem at the present time is major evolution. There's nothing changed. At that time, there was not a total stress on natural selection. At the present time, there's not a total stress on natural selection. The third problem for Darwin was the clergy. He had an internal problem because he originally started off to be a clergyman himself. His wife was also very religious. Now, Darwin's ideas were quite contrary to the prevailing opinion of that time. Darwin stated in his Origin of Species that they were not fixed at the time of the creation. Darwin proposed that evolution was a result of essentially natural processes requiring no creative intervention. He didn't talk about the origin of man. He was afraid to in the origin. But it was his implications about the origin of man that caused some problem. Now, while Democritus in 450 BC started some of our modern concepts about the universe. Some people have said he was the first developed atomic theory. And Copernicus in 1500s argued convincingly that the sun wasn't the center of the, was at the center, not the earth. It wasn't until Darwin that came along that you changed totally the concept that really man was the most important. Up until Darwin's writing, taken from, in fact, the fifth day of the Genesis account, wherein God fashioned the universe for the benefit of the earth. The earth he then placed man on to look after the most important part of his universe. Man has always seen himself as the center of the universe, the most important being in the universe, the one thing that's different. And what Charles Darwin came along with his thesis, he called for a drastic change. Man wasn't special, and basically the religious people didn't like to make that change. Darwin accepted creation. Darwin said, "I believe in the beginning the Creator might have breathed life into four or five forms at the most. But I believe that this occurred a long time ago in the dim distant past and is largely irrelevant to the explanation of the current forms of life. But he did accept creation as another model. There was then a creationist debate. As I pointed out, Darwin didn't have an acceptable explanation for the source of variation. He believed in blending inheritance. He knew that it wasn't right. He wanted an alternative. A number of people, particularly Fleming Jenkin, professor of engineering at Glasgow, pointed out that blending inheritance doesn't work because in time you lose the variation. And it wasn't until the discovery or rediscovery of Mendel's laws, particularly Mendel's laws on particulate inheritance, the rediscovery by Hugo de Vries, Carl Correns, and others, that the foundation of modern genetics was established, the particulate inheritance idea. But this, the discovery of what we call modern genetics, did not help Darwin's theory. In fact, it did the opposite. The original genetics information was taken to refute Darwin's ideas on natural selection. The early Mendelians studied quantitative characters in individuals, characters with discrete differences, what you would see now, blue eyes versus brown eyes, things like this. When de Vries was working on the evening primrose, he also discovered that new types arise all at once without preparation, what he said, by mutation. And he laid the groundwork in this discovery for what came to be called the mutation theory for natural selection. De Vries and Johansson argued that evolution took place through the spontaneous origin of new types, new mutants, that were radically different from the previous forms. They saw evolution as a sequence of mutations. And they said that natural selection did nothing but eliminate the things that didn't change. It eliminated, natural selection was a negative force. It wasn't a guiding force. Mutation was the guiding force. And very conveniently, the mutational theory, of course, does not predict intermediates. It is consistent with the fossil record. A spontaneous mutation bringing a new form, you would not have intermediates. You will not require gaps in the fossil record. Now, the new debate amongst the Darwinians, what has become known as the neo-Darwinian debate, came along with the discovery of quantitative genetics, the realization that you have more continuous genetic variation with a multiple control for which you must go to the population to measure. And it was the emphasis on the population that led to the development of modern population genetics and the modern theory of evolution by natural selection. It's basically dated at 1930 with R.A. Fisher's book, The Genetic Theory of Natural Selection. And this talked about changes not in individual genes, but in populations of genes. It involves differential fitness in populations, but I won't go into that in detail. The neo-Darwinians modified Darwin's concept of natural selection and for the first time took the genetic information and put it together with natural selection to make a theory that seemed to hold up. Not only did they bring a theory, they also went out and were able to carry out experiments in the field. They were able to see and produce evidence for natural selection. The classic example, of course, is the work by Kettlewell on the different colored pepper moths, wherein in the industrial regions of Britain you get black moths, in the country region you have pale moths, and if the moths sit on the wrong background that you can see some and not the others, there is a black moth and there is the white one also hidden. There are two moths there. This is what Kettleswell has called Darwin's missing evidence. It was an actual demonstration of natural selection in action, and they knew the genetic basis. Not only did the neo-Darwinians demonstrate natural selection in action, but they were able to show that it occurred everywhere they looked, and it seemed to be of sufficient magnitude to account for all of the variation that one would search for. So much so that in the literature leading up to only a few years ago, many evolutionists said that there is only one guiding force to evolution, natural selection. One process, what has been called the heavenly power of Darwinian natural selection, or Croesus called it Darwin's demon. Now, this is the new change, the new debate amongst evolutionists. What has been realized is that natural selection is not the sole guiding force. There are other forces involved. There are other processes involved. There are the process of neutral substitution, duplication, founder effects, jumping genes. You can name numerous ones, all of which are at the present time heatly debated by evolutionists. Now, the creationists have seen this as a sign of weakness. Here we have the evolutionists with a very solid theory based upon natural selection, and now we find the evolutionists in disarray because they can't agree as to what the theory is and what the processes are involved. Just because natural selection is now regarded as perhaps a minor force doesn't mean that the evolutionary theory is not a sound one, that natural processes are not involved. To disprove natural selection in every case as being a minor, or to prove that it's a minor force, does not prove that creation there should replace it. What the creationists are doing, or have done, is to not realize the way that science goes on. Science doesn't stick by laws that we put in granite and hence can't get rid of them. Science tends to be dependent upon the factual information available at any one time. There's a new debate amongst evolutionists. It is not a weakness of evolutionists, it's their strength. Now, right at the present time, Medawar has pointed out, and quite correctly, that there is widespread dissatisfaction in the evolutionary camp. A lot of people are dissatisfied, but they're not sure what they're dissatisfied about. There are three problems at the present time, and I do not have time to go into all of them. I'm only going to mention one. There's still the religious problem, which is where we started off. But as Medawar points out, whereas once the complaint was that evolution took place at all, the complaint now is that it takes place without divine motivation. The creationists have put new input into this argument, but they in no way have they changed the argument. The points are the same as they were right at the beginning. The methods of the scientists are totally different to the methods of the creationists. Let me quote Moore. Moore, in his account of the creation in California, he says, in general, the strict creationists reject the statements and the procedures of the scientist because they feel that they do not lead to God. The evolutionists reject the statements and the procedures of the creationists because they do not lead to an acceptable scientific method. Moore says the creationists search nature for conclusions they've already reached. This is not a method acceptable to scientists. The scientists do not have methods. The scientists and creationists do not have methods that can be at all accepted by the other camp. The debate will never be resolved. It has not moved beyond the Darwin period. There is no answer to the question, evolution or special creation, because neither the scientist nor the creationist can really pose that question. It is not in their terms of reference. The evolutionary theory is necessary for scientists because the scientists embarked upon a search for knowledge of the universe. The creation myth is necessary for human comfort, for those that cannot embark on that search, who do not wish to embark on that search. To put it another way, evolutionary theory doesn't really clash with religious faith. It's a mistake to take the Holy Scriptures, as I pointed out, as elementary textbooks in astronomy, geology, biology, or anthropology. As Dobzhansky noted, only if symbols are construed to mean what they were never intended to mean, can there arise an imaginary, insoluble conflict. I've noted earlier that there's a host of creation myths among all of the tribes and religions of the world. Garrett Hardin, when he addressed the National Association of Biology Teaching Convention a few years ago, said that to single out the story of Genesis is to establish a state religion. And that's against the Constitution. It is not possible to ask evolution or special creation. It never needs to be asked. There is no conflict. Thank you.
Professor Scudder has agreed to take questions. May I ask that they be fairly short? Well, there's a limited time, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who will have questions to put. No, nobody brave enough to start? Yes?
What about Oparin?
What about?
Oparin's theory.
In what way do you wish to
start everything?
Oparin's theory is quite acceptable in the sense of the scientific world. It wouldn't be acceptable to the creationists, of course. But Oparin's theory on the origin of living forms from non-living is the one that, in general, is the guide for all experiments in the laboratory now on the origin of life, using Urey atmosphere and so on.
Next. It's got to be somebody who will take issue with what's been said.
I have a question regarding the sequence of the evolution of life. The evolution of things getting it better than the progressive reason.
Yep. The fundamental creation theory plus the progressive requires that all forms, major forms, were created at the same time.
That's a progressive
creation. As well, yes, because they say that we're just interpreting kinds. We're not changing the time sequence. We're just saying that the major kinds were created. The fundamentalists believe that all species were created at the same time. The progressive believe that it was kinds, the major groups. But if you have the major groups all created at the same time, they should all occur in the fossil record at the one time. If we go to Precambrian, we should find all of them.
So an adaption of the progressive creation model, if their time sequence has changed, then...
Oh, you can modify, yeah, there are progressive people. Yeah, they can then stretch a day to... 500,000 years, which is the way that one can handle that. Yes.
Up here.
You mentioned a number of
ways that a number of mechanisms by which species change, in addition to natural selection. Mm-hmm. What is your preference? I mean, is there a, do you have a particular theory of evolution?
I have some pet methods, yes. And at the moment, one can't describe them in detail. I tend to go along with St. Hilaire that the secret is in development. That any form, once it's embarked upon a development process, if that development doesn't change, is bound to finish up as the same form. Once a human being goes development, as soon as it's gone past a certain point, it is bound to be a human being. Once a fly starts on the way to be a fly after so much, it's always going to be a fly, it can be never anything different. Now, we don't understand at the present time development. We do not know how to take DNA and get it to read sequentially to develop a form. It's just not in the ballpark at the moment. We know how you can transcribe DNA to get enzymes and things like this, but we do not understand the control of form. If you do not understand the control of form, how can you understand the modification of form? And I believe that the only way of understanding these major changes and major departures is to understand development. When we understand development, then I believe we'll understand how you modify it in any major way. This is, there's nothing original in this. So Waddington and others have been saying this for a long, long time. If you read many of the modern embryological texts that are, the embryologists that are interested in evolution, they are putting forward this idea. It's one of the new things. And it's been there since St. Hilaire, 1700, 1800. It's just that it got stamped on by the neo-Darwinians who said it couldn't work. Goldschmidt liked the idea in a slightly modified form, but he was said to talk about hopeful monsters, and that terminology, of course, throws it out. You can't form anything from a hopeful monster. So that there are many things going on. For example, the biochemists are now finding that you have neutral substitutions, amino acids in protein evolution. In fact, duplication and substitutions are the main method of protein evolution. Now, that's neutral substitution is non-Darwinian. Now, we can talk about non-Darwinian evolution. This is a big thing that's being debated at the present time. So all I'm saying is that Darwin had many processes. There was a period in the what we call the neo-Darwinian era where everybody concentrated on natural selection. We've now moved back to the Darwinian period with many processes. And the big debate between creationists is really with the strict neo-Darwinians. And they're only arguing with, in fact, a stance which we've lost. We've gone beyond that. So that at the moment, evolutionists really find the debate sterile because the statements of the creationists are not ones that evolutionists accept. But I can't tell you the process. Again, I pointed out, science never claimed to be able to find the process or a process. We never claim to find the final answer. We just claim that this method is the one that we should travel along, rather than first choice taking a myth. But a myth is quite acceptable. Does not bother me at all if my brother believes in a myth. That's quite acceptable. He doesn't take the scientific route. And I think that if you take away the myth concept, if you remove the Genesis account and do not put something in its place, then you're going to have trouble. So there is nothing wrong with adhering to the Genesis account, providing you do not teach it as a science. As long as you teach it as a myth, no problem.
I read some scientific report that if creation was not almost instantaneous, things wouldn't gel. There's some of the protons, neutrons, and electrons. I don't understand, but said it had to be almost instantaneous.
I'm going to restrict my attention. I've been talking about the origins of life and diversity, and I purposely didn't get down to the origin of the universe. That is not my ballpark. The person sitting next to you can answer that better than I can. Yes. Yes. Well, in general, the textbook publishers tend to, of course, concern themselves with the places where they can publish the largest number, sell the largest number of texts. California school system is the largest purchaser of textbooks. And as a result of the requirements of the California school system, all schools have the same text, which now says that evolution is a theory and not a fact. But I pointed out that really there is no conflict. There is an evolutionary theory and there is evolution of the fact. And this is one of the problems for the evolutionists. They've never attempted, and it's been pointed out, they never attempted to upgrade the statements on evolution of the textbooks from the time of Scopes' trial. The Scopes trial, all evolution was removed from textbooks. It has crept back in, but the statements are no better than they were at the time of Scopes. And there have been modifications, though the textbooks we use in general here are the American texts. I don't know what's happened in Europe. I couldn't tell you whether they've gone through quite the same process, but it's a typical American debate at the present time.
Wonder if I might make a comment on that, which I think the wheel has gone full circle. In the Times of London about a year ago, it was reported that a teacher in Wimbledon lost his job for teaching the creationist view of evolution.
Maybe you could repeat that for the people up above.
The comment was that in Wimbledon,
I think it was Wimbledon, South London,
a year or so ago, a teacher lost his job for teaching the creation theory of evolution.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you, ask you a question as a scientist. You said that a scientist is bound by his methods, and given modern philosophy of science, since any scientist can expect that and even hope that his theories will be refuted at some later date and the whole enterprise will move forward, to what is he bound and why?
I'd have to think about that one. I guess he's just bound to a different faith. One up the back.
On your comment on this creation theory, I really don't find any problems, because I imagine that any supreme being clever enough to create all these living things we see would also be clever enough to create fossils, put them in different strata of the rock. Also clever enough to set up different kinds of different racial contests and arguments.
I find it difficult, but it's put forward as an idea, as a defense by some. Yeah.
I think the most important thing said is that it will never be resolved, and this is really not counter. I think I would be just as alarmed if the creationists resolved beyond a doubt that they were right, because that would remove choice from man, which is basically what we're supposed to be left with.
One.
because of natural interest, how did the creationists explain the disappearance of so many vast numbers of forms, particularly the Mesozoic era, that took place when they suggested that all forms were created in the first instance?
I don't know. There's one difficulty in talking about the creationist view, and that is that in general they do not put forward a view other than adhering to the statements in Genesis. And most of the books by creationists are really attacks on evolution. And if you read them, you do not find a clear statement in them as to what they believe and how they would explain particular facts. You can take any one of them and you will never find a clear statement and a clear handling of all of the available facts. It just isn't available, at least I've not come across it. If somebody has a nice book which puts it forward to explain all of the scientific facts that we have to deal with, it would be useful. Do you have one?
It's really not a question. It's really not a problem. Because once you accept the idea, it doesn't, the problem ceases to exist.
Right. One more there.
Could you just explain a little bit about what the evolutionary theory would, what the basic idea is on the origin of matter?
I wouldn't want to go into matter and energy. I think you better set up another Vancouver Institute talk with another speaker.
There's one anxious one up there.
Why can't we live without men?
Basically, well, it's my view and the view of a number of others is that if you are attempting to always rely upon your understanding of the thing, that you have very limited scope. That is, that if without knowledge of with a limited knowledge at any one period of time, you're apt to get frustrated. This is the simplest form of it. And frustration is not a very acceptable thing.
Are there any myths that you believe in?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Walking under ladders or something like that.
You hang up your stocking at Christmas. Is that, have you had enough?
Yeah, okay.
Professor Scudder, I think it's been imposed on long enough. Whether God created the flu virus or it evolved, when God was out to lunch, Professor Scudder has the flu bug, and I think we've probably had Adam quite enough. I'll ask Professor Horror, if you would, to thank the speaker. Where's Professor Gore? Is he not here?
Yeah,
of course. Hey, wait a bit.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, evolution or special creation, apparently the question shouldn't have been asked, but we have learned in Jeffrey Scudder's lecture that this question contains some of the most challenging problems of modern biology. Jeffrey Scudder is himself something of a special creation. In a different way, perhaps, than you think. He heads a department of specialists. We attempt to turn out highly specialized students in various areas. He is a specialist himself in entomology and carries the responsibility for teaching the introductory and all of the entomology actually that's given in our department. At the same time, he gives an outstanding course in comparative anatomy of vertebrates and a course in evolution that has become well known not only in this university but across Canada. I think this evening he has demonstrated something of the breadth of his scholarship, and I'd ask you to join me in showing our appreciation the usual way.